our mass recording.
We'll try this.
Basically, when I put together these slides last night, I started out with what I thought was a fairly simple strategy. I put together, kind of glued together two presentations that were done at the Semantic Technology Conferences over the last couple of years, and I figured I could just pull out a handful of slides, get some of the basic ideas across, and then actually run you through an exercise based on a methodology I developed for a large telecommunications equipment manufacturer in the Bay Area. I don't know if I can name them or 10 years, but, you know, there might be, still be some non-disclosure running around. The problem was, as I went through the slides, I went, well, that one's pretty good, and that one's pretty good, and that one's pretty good. And by the time I was done, I think I had 60 slides. So my goal is to get through these in about 10 minutes and then go through the exercise. I don't think I will succeed. And because of that, I'll be moving quickly. I will not be covering everything on every slide. That information is there, so you can go pick it up later if you're interested. But if I am going too fast, by all means, slow me down, stop me, and I'll spend more time on specific topics. So this is kind of the work of what we affectionately call or regard ourselves as the ontology management team. I'll describe them in a little bit of detail. And then look at the issues of semantics being dynamic and take a look at some approaches and strategies that we've been kind of thinking through over the last couple of years for how to deal with this phenomenon of dynamic semantics, what happens when meanings change within the human and social ontologies that we work with. So first off, the ontology management team, kind of an outgrowth of Ontolog. Bob, needless to say, is a heavy participant. Bo Newman participates every once in a while. And there's another gentleman I've been working with for about 10 years now, Joe Beck, who's now with Eastern Kentucky University. A lot of the values-based concepts that you'll see are really kind of an outgrowth of his work. So what's ontology management team all about? Well, the key thing is, as we were looking at a lot of discussion on ontology engineering, we began to feel there was kind of something missing. And that was the management practices that would support and enable effective ontology engineering projects. So that kind of was the starting point for this. The approach we're trying to take is to bridge these theoretical problem engineering domains, come up with kind of a general set of management principles that would apply in ontology development. We're also suspecting that it will also help deal more effectively with policy development activities in large enterprises. We tend to focus more on the what we call the natural ontology, the individual and social ontologies, the way people conceptualize and the way they reach agreement around those conceptualizations as a prerequisite for formalization and engineering exercises. These policy vectors, I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. I think it just does a pretty good job of explaining a little bit kind of where we're coming from, how we approach these things. Here for future reference. And with that, I've saved a number of minutes. We're into the first issue. So what do we mean by this idea of dynamic semantics? Well, the core of the argument is that meaning changes through time, and there's actually this flow through from these personal individual ontologies into the social agreements around those. Then you'll have some sort of engineering or formalization exercise to create those explicit ontologies, which are used by automated agents. And that's kind of the general chain of thought. The problem, however, is that people change their minds. And the way they think today is not the way they think tomorrow. And the agreements you have today are not necessarily agreements that you'll be able to hold tomorrow. And all that churn can, if not properly addressed or considered, impact adversely your formalization exercises and limit the functionality that you're trying to automate. And that's kind of the flip side from the other direction. Formalization does not in and of itself stabilize meaning because it's not an inherent property, but it's associated through human interaction and human thought. And I think I said most of this, or enough of it. So what's the approach that you can take for this? Well, the first one we started working with is the idea of taking a look at what we consider the transformational origins of these semantic changes. And let's see, anything I want to say here. A couple of models, knowledge vector model, that's what we're really going to focus on a bit. And then an extension of that, what we're calling the meta-knowledge continuum model. So this is the basic knowledge vector model. This is courtesy of Bo Newman. This is stuff he's been working on for about 20 years. And the basic idea is data is transformed information, which is transformed into knowledge. That knowledge is used to enable a knowledge utilization event, effectively an action or a decision. And this is kind of a standard model that we use in understanding knowledge management and knowledge policy generally. The key caution here is that the boundaries between data, information, and knowledge are not necessarily discrete. You can view those as sort of a continuum, but at the same time, there's some sort of elevation of semantic meaning through time that differentiates data from knowledge. And so this model kind of gets into that idea, that when we're dealing with data artifacts, there's a set of metadata that is associated with those artifacts in that form. When you're at the informational level, there's a different, slightly different set of properties that could be associated with it, and the same with meta-knowledge. Now, what this does then is really set the stage for a series of semantics. And so we've taken this range of semantics and we've broken it down now in terms of kind of classes of semantics. And the first one that we've identified is interpretive semantics. These are associated with data. As you move up in the informational realm, then you're dealing with semantics that tend to deal more with context. A couple principles here. When we're getting into knowledge and behaviors, you're looking at aspirational semantics. These tend to be the goals and the drivers. And then finally, behavioral semantics. Now, these are critically important, and if you take a look at a lot of really the high-end formalizations that are taking place, semantic formalization involves really trying to pin down and make explicit critical behavioral semantics. And so the key thing here that kind of helps us is this anchors a lot of the axiomatic formalization, but recognize there are other semantic properties as well that are critical to making sense of this information and making it actionable. And those other categories can become important, perhaps even more important than the behavioral semantics. So this gave us kind of a general strategy, trying to formalize this meta-knowledge. And if you're going to try to address the change, what can you do? Well, three simple options. I'm sure there are more. You can ignore the volatility. Just ignore the fact that meaning is going to change through time and figure, you know, we've got a system that works. You can try to stomp it. You can say, no, this is the meaning, and we're going to hold to that, and we're not going to allow the meaning to shift or change. And then the last one is really the idea of embracing, trying to recognize it will change and make sure that your systems and processes and policies address that. Semantic nirvana, and this was just kind of a real simple way of looking at a lot of the formalization that people get excited at, thinking that's going to be a major solution for this issue. The problem we see with a lot of this fully formalized predicate logic is it's really a two-step semantic resolution model. There's symbol identification. Once you've mapped the symbol to a concept, now we're going to define that concept axiomatically in terms of behavioral semantics, and we're leaving entire classes of semantics effectively undefined. And it's up to the humans to provide those, and if it's not formalized in any way, and it's up to human interpretation, then that can cause breakdowns through time. So key findings here, you know, uncertainty's out there. It's difficult to formalize around it, but if you can understand where the change is coming from and then document to your best understanding, that will tend to give you an ability to handle the changes more rationally through time. And so because of that, we developed this concept in meta-knowledge formalization. And the idea is to really take a look at each of those semantic classes, figure out which ones are critical for the application or agreement space that you're dealing with, and then go ahead and start formalizing those. When the full presentation, we actually gave, I think it was about a half dozen examples of where this principle had been applied in specific applications and which classes of meta-knowledge, which semantic classes, were actually dominant or predominant in those applications. Some of the benefits, although without seeing examples, I don't know this is going to make a lot of sense. You can get into this fairly easily. It doesn't have to be a huge capture everything, but more capture what you know about the knowledge and its rationale as you go along. It relies on the existence of implicit and tacit knowledge within the organization and actually leverages that in a way that's fairly interesting. And a key thing was we saw this really the starting point for trying to come up with some rational ontology management practices, which is really what drove us there in the first place. Excuse me. Another approach, and this is really from the presentation we made this year, focuses on human values and the role of human values in semantic association. And our belief was that if we have a better understanding of the mechanisms and dynamics associated with that, that may give us another way of dealing with some of these trickier semantic codification issues. And the basic point here is that values can be considered a technology because decision-making is expensive. To go back through and rethink everything time and time again takes a lot of time, takes a lot of effort, and you know, if a tiger's going to jump out and grab you, you may not have time to actually think through big and furry and hairy and big teeth, and I see a claw, let's see the teeth, well, that could hit me in the head, claw could hit me in the body, you know, you may not have time to think through all that. So if we can speed up decision-making somewhat, that tends to be beneficial in many contexts. And we see values really as one of the key mechanisms that humans use to do that. It effectively, values effectively abstract or decontextualize knowledge in order to make it generalizable and reduce the processing in order to apply basic rules in similar or even sometimes dissimilar contexts. The problem, however, and this is kind of one of the issues with going down this road, is that just as it can make a decision more instantaneous, more automated, it may not be contextually appropriate. And so we also see in enterprises where a dominant value system may actually drive detrimental or inappropriate behaviors. And so the trick is to know when are the values helping you, when are the values hurting you. And needless to say, values are going to have some impact in meaning generally. Some of the organizational issues, I think you've probably experienced all these, if not thought about them on occasion. So to get back to how values work and how they impact semantics, we go back to that knowledge vector model. And the point being that really all those transformations are where the expense comes from. And you know, how many of you are in academics or had to be in academics or pretend to be in academics or remember academics and had to work with the scientific method? The first time you applied it, did you get it correct? Probably not. So going through all the steps and making everything explicit, we can do it, but that isn't the way we necessarily work on a day-to-day basis. And so this process, although it exists, is not the way that things tend to go all the time. So what we find in the real world is we take all these knowledge vectors, these D to I to K, KU thingies, and that becomes the body of experience. And through time, we're going to synthesize it. We're going to figure out which of those patterns we can trust, what we believe in, what we consider perceived truth or reliability. That then gets elevated to the concept of values, at least in this model. And then wisdom is basically, in this model, the ability to balance competing values and choose the correct or appropriate optimizations in a given context. So just some quick definitions. Anything I need to get here? I think really the main point to walk away with is the idea that this dissociation is a form of knowledge compression, that we're taking that body of experience, we're synthesizing it or compressing it, reducing it to a smaller set of knowledge artifacts so you don't have to go back and interact with all that experience in every case. And this basically just takes the model that I showed you earlier, renames it slightly. Instead of talking about meta-knowledge, we're talking really about subject segmentation. So it really just kind of reinforces. The one that you saw before changes the labeling a little bit. And now we're going to look at the impact of values on semantic association. Again, not going to go into a lot of detail here, but the point being that we can identify mechanisms whereby a value system is going to impact the association of meaning within each of those segments. And this then serves as a basis for further understanding and analytical methodologies. A lot in contextualization. What patterns you see are the patterns that you are able to see, have been trained to see, have seen before usually. Aspirational semantics, a lot of area for conflict there, value systems, especially value conflict, and then finally behaviors. And then, you know, no presentation like this can possibly be complete without the requisite Dilbert cartoon. And so here we're going to talk about their values, and their values are very simple. Results, or what was it? I need my glasses for this one. Bias for action and passion for results, but you'll notice the meaning of those two values is not necessarily clear to Wally. And then the basic conclusions from this module, values, not facts drive decisions. And because of this, and this is kind of how we pitched the presentation, values, the ultimate semantic technology. We figured that'd be kind of something the technologists would find amusing, if not adversarial. And then we kind of looked at some of these values-based methods and kind of revisiting them again. And we actually had a few conversations, at least with an outfit based in Colorado, and trying to do some ontology-based or values-based ontology development. So use values as the framework for actually codifying the semantic properties as opposed to using other mechanisms. Not quite sure how that would work, but it looks like it might have some promise. Certainly as an adjunct to axiomatic-based approaches, and when you're getting into the consensus area, values tend to become absolutely critical, and so it certainly has application there. Well, with that, I got through this in 12 minutes. Was that fun? I feel like I accomplished something. And so at this point, with the flash flurry, let's go do any catch. Anybody have any questions before I move on to the next piece? It was overwhelming, or it was obvious? Overwhelming? Well, I can try to underwhelm. Anybody want me to say anything else on any particular? I'm not getting much feedback here. Okay. So let's kind of go to the next step and say, how would this work in the real world? And so we have here what we're going to describe. I'm going to describe a semantic consensus acceleration process. In the first iteration, it was actually called CAT, for consensus acceleration teams, but I don't have a team in front of me today, so I've turned it into a generic process. The idea here is that, and this came from a large telecommunications company, and the basic issue they were facing was metadata interoperability. Numerous systems all over the place built by individual teams, and they got to the point where they could not exchange information between them. Systems that should be able to match up with each other simply couldn't. And part of they initially thought it was a metadata issue, and it was. But the path that we took to solve it was actually to start with something fairly simple, and that was to normalize, please. Metadata. So I have a document. What data do I have stored about that document? So what product does it pertain to? Who wrote it? When was it written? Maybe I've got a graphic. What's that graphic about? Okay, so they had all these databases and document systems out there. And when you looked at the databases that managed those things, you know, the various fields and properties should line up, but they didn't. And so you couldn't easily take information from engineering and get in the technical documentation system and have it fit where it needed to go. Someone had to look at it and interpret it and figure out how to make it fit. Well, that works for relatively small things, but when you're dealing with, you know, what, 500 software releases and maybe a couple thousand products, you know, just at that point, having a human figure out each one of those breaks down. And in fact, the product was actually one of the primary examples that drove the strategy. I did one quick little afternoon study. I found 25 variations on the same product name. Well, as humans, they could read that and understand what product was being talked about, but the search and retrieval systems couldn't actually index 25 variations and assign them all to the same product. And so the focus here was, let's standardize that terminology, let's standardize the corporate language, and needless to say, there were going to be some semantic issues associated with standardizing the language, and that's why this became effectively a semantic exercise. The approach that we took was to use cross-cultural teams. So we got people from marketing, engineering, technical documentation, personnel, and anybody else who you know really wanted to participate. It was a pretty open process. And the reason we did that is because we knew that the basic value system, the mindset, and the way that they assign meaning to these names and terms and concepts was going to change across those groups. And that was the consensus that we were trying to accelerate, the consensus of terminology and meaning across these diverse communities. We gave them basically what we call a semantic work package. We went in and took a variety of databases and systems, went in, extracted the terms, literally concepts, but really it was terminology-based, and then organized them and clustered them in terms of in groups of related terms. Please.
Well, back to your definition of metadata, you know, all those things that you mentioned are sort of properties of the document.
Right.
So that's not really meta for me if I'm thinking about documents.
Right. Well, and that's, I think, that was one of the reasons we introduced the term meta-knowledge as opposed to just metadata. Because metadata seems to be the stuff that's focused on what we know about the data object, right? But when we get into the informational aspects of it, then context becomes important and classification becomes important. Okay. And so that can be considered a type of metadata, but since we're really talking about something a little different than just data elements, I think the term meta-knowledge becomes a little more useful there. And, you know, and to extend that, right, then when we're looking at the knowledge artifact itself, well, what were the things that went into the transformation from it being simply information to knowledge? What made it actually able to drive a behavior or a decision? And so that's another set of properties or another set of semantics that could be associated with it. And then finally, the aspirational one. What are you trying to accomplish? I'm building a car? Am I building a rocket? Am I trying to dig a ditch? And those aspirational semantics then will put really another set of meta properties layered. That's the more interesting stuff. Yeah, definitely, but it's the harder to explain. So I gave the simple explanation, but the point of this model is to try to recognize there's a really broad continuum out here. And I find the term metadata, although a lot of people use it, actually, like you say, to not be as useful because people think they understand it when there are like 12 or 13 different schools of thought out there. Yeah. I don't know if that helped answer the question or not. So anyway, the idea was here, we give them a set of terms, have them identify the various concepts that are related to it, relate them, differentiate them, come up with some initial definitions, and then try to reach agreement on what this stuff all means. The key thing here, I think, is pretty critical, is that these teams were not engineering teams. You know, we may have had people from engineering, but they weren't necessarily language engineers. And we weren't trying to get them to come up with complete ontological formalizations. We're trying to get them to define a consensus point that would effectively function as a requirement or a set of specifications to the ontology engineering groups. And so here's the process. Once they're given a set of terms, do some research. Go out and poke around, look these things up in Google or on your internal website and see what you can find out. And kind of the key thing there is that list complete, is that set complete, or are there some other terms and resources that should be brought into the conversation and understood? Next step is this idea of inventorying the semantics. This is where we're trying to get from terminologies into concepts. So try to identify the concepts that are associated with these terms and either define or identify some working definitions. What do we mean by these concepts? Identify the core concepts. What's really the main thing that all this stuff hinges on, and look at how the other terms and concepts relate back to this core concept. Try to get some idea of what the relationships look like. You know, make pictures if you can. Step three, begin to normalize the semantics. Go back and take a look at those definitions. Now try to refine the working definitions into something that's actually publishable and could be used going forward. Let's try to really anchor those concepts. Validate those definitions. Is the definition complete? Does it address the corner cases, missing stuff, whatever? And of course, document the supporting rationales becomes really critical at this point. And then once that's been done, and this was really one of the primary goals of this project, so we had a specific step for normalizing the terminology. For each concept, what's the term that should be used by the vast majority of people when trying to describe this concept? What's the best product name when we're trying to document a product name? It was really the idea of, you know, is it complete? Does it describe all of what you're talking about? And where we found the particular issues were really in the boundaries of the corner cases. Does it define a clean line saying this is in and that's out? And it's those boundary conditions that we saw most of the debate and focus on. And the reality was, given the time that these teams were allowed to work on this stuff, because it was a very accelerated schedule, the definitions we got were fairly shoddy. But with it, we got the list of issues, and that told us where we needed to focus to try to clarify later. One of the best examples I've seen within the last week or so on this is the definition of clouds. Clouds. Evidently, there's a big issue in meteorology today because the definition of clouds has been completely destabilized. Definitions that have been placed for decades have broken. Anybody tell me why? That's really cool. Yeah. We're used to looking up at clouds, and all the definitions were based on us sitting on Earth looking up at clouds. Now, how do meteorologists look at clouds? They look down at clouds. The definitions no longer work. And they don't have the new ones yet. and they're trying to figure them out. And specifically those boundaries and corner cases, because they're getting additional detail that they didn't have before, right? Additional dynamics that weren't being considered before, additional properties, additional considerations, additional implications for different semantic properties. So the whole thing's kind of in a state of flux. That could be more stable. Yeah. Yeah, probably. How about truth? I mean, it works for some stuff. There you go. Yeah, so I think, you know, going back to fundamentals works for some stuff, it may not work for other stuff. Oh, no, please.
So there is a big tension there. Look for consensus with this social doctrine, and I call it social doctrine, but that's this whole talk about things in common. Or we try to understand some sort of physical truths or objective truth that will sort of withstand some of this dynamic process that you're talking about understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that. I know
I think the answer is yes, because sometimes you can do one and it's optimal, and other times you can't do it and you got to use something else. And one of the best examples we had out of these teams, I remember one, and we formed this team, and we had this guy from marketing, and I mean, he was sharp. He came in and he spoke, and the words were, you know, they're like oil paintings. They were just full and rich, and you went, I can just sit here and listen to you. It's wonderful, it's wonderful. And the team was focusing on switch and router. And he knew the answer. And he was very helpful. Blah, 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 and blah, 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 blah. Cool. Then they went out and did their research. Came back, well, what about switch router? And now they're trying to define switch router in terms of the boundaries they put on switches and routers. And then they had a problem. And it was about four sessions. And finally, at the fourth session, he came back and he said, I just realized. I knew what this stuff was 4 years ago. In the last 4 years, it's changed, and my entire way of thinking about it doesn't even apply anymore. You know, and that's kind of thing. Are we dealing with something concrete where you can break it down into constituent pieces or components or theories or foundations or laws even? Or is it something which is really far more nebulous and you're right, you're into the human realm? Yeah.
And I think that my sense of it is push more for the objective things. We try to so many. Get the text over with the team to localize. So you take your example and then you start in Japan.
Well, like I said, I think if you can do that, it's an excellent strategy. The thing that comes to mind, however, is that most of the money in this game right now has to do with intelligence. And I don't know that there's a physics of terrorism that you can use to come up with concrete boundaries. Maybe 50 years, I don't know.
More mundane question.
Please.
When you were dealing with this team and that there's different terms and definitions, how did you expect all that information?
It was basically this. I did not sanitize this document. But this was basically what we gave the teams. And it says, are you lost in a semantic jungle? Use a cat. Wasn't that cute? I didn't do it. I disavow any decision making in that. But what it had was basically the process. Here's the multi-step process laid out with a summary of deliverables. And then for each step, it was basically, this is what we're trying to get you to do. This is what we want you to think about. And this is what information and knowledge we want you to capture about it when you do it. No. No, this is a document. It was not produced by Excel. I'm sorry. This is a Word document, so they basically just extend the table and capture it that way. Again, because this is really an input to an engineering process, it wasn't like we were going to construct huge databases of this stuff. It really tended to define the issues and the areas that need to be focused on. Now, at some point after they ran a whole bunch of these, yeah, they might have tried to get him into a database of one form or another. I'm not sure what they did. Yeah, I was a contractor. At some point, my contract ended, so the project lived on. But yeah, the basic idea was we had this mostly reduced to tables, and they could fill out and scan the tables, and we had the data in a semi-structured form. We could consolidate or do whatever we needed to do to it. Something here likes me. Last thought. Let's kind of bop through this, and then we'll have about a half hour to pretend to do an exercise. So look at the normative term for the concept. What's the way we should talk about this thing? What should everyone agree to, or hopefully everybody can agree to? Document the term's origins and history or pedigree. And we found that to be fairly important, again, because this stuff was changing. And was this a term that came out of engineering, or a term that came out of marketing, or a term that came from, you know, kind of standard industry origins? Alternative semantics. Is the term overloaded? Does it have multiple meanings? Because that might influence what we use for the normative term for the concept. And then this idea of aliases. What are the various other terms that are used to describe this concept so we can hopefully inform the indexing system what to look for when it finds this concept? So with that, I am done with my official talk, and I welcome a new participant. How are you? Wonderful. Thank you. And the idea here was let's kind of just as an exercise run through this and see what it's like. And I was hoping to have someone give me a really cool list of terms that we should try to disambiguate today. So I didn't come up with one. So let's come up with a list of terms that we think we need to disambiguate. Anybody have any suggestions? Task. Okay. Let's shoot for about 4 or 5, maybe 6 at the top. Wow. Okay. These all relate to the same concept? I'm going to throw agent out because, well, actually I'm going to throw capability out too, and I'll tell you why. These are both behavioral, and let's try to at least stay in the behavioral domain. Ideally, these terms all are really close to each other, and I think capability and agent are too far out. So I'm going to veto those for our exercise. I would not have clumped those together into a work package. I'm sorry. Something more behavior-oriented. Order. Okay, Jack, it's amusing.
I'm going to talk about federation, and you're going precisely the opposite direction. You're going to be so much funner than I thought.
Cool. Well, I've wanted to talk to you about federation for a long time. So.
Well, federation is about taking authority out and letting all possible worldviews come in. And I'm watching you throw out a priori somebody else's views. And this is exactly what goes on in ontological engineering. You weed out the things that aren't amenable to what you have in mind, which means you deny a bunch of other people the access to those worldviews for specific reasons. I'm not saying it's bad. Okay? I mean, if you go to a medical doctor and you say, diagnose, or you want to say, the doctor says you have this, you better say, I think you have this. Otherwise, you're not going to trust me. So I understand the need for a project to do it, but I'm going to talk to the other side of the fence.
Good. Well, in the real world, all these other things, they'd be sitting out here in the queue. It isn't like they would just simply disappear.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. So. Yeah. I'm not that brutal. Am I? No, anyway. So, couple more, one more.
Management.
That's kind of behavioral. In the spirit of Jack, I will include it. This is such a cluster right now. I don't know that vector actually diverges it too much. So let's say we're going to go out and research this. hidden agenda. Huh? Cloud? Oh, hell, why not? Okay. Put them all in. I don't care. Okay. Huh? Well, the boundary, any logical boundary was broken a long time ago. So anyway, imagine that you've been given this set of terms now. And you're going to go out and research them. So we go through the research phase. And the question is, for kind of the thing we're talking about, is this a complete set? This is really all the terminology that describes this set of stuff. Probably not, especially as diverse as this is. So what other terms are likely to come out of our research that's expected to be important? Okay. Have we got someone on the phone, Peter?
Someone on the phone?
Yeah.
Can you hear it?
Not really.
I'm at the what? I can hold the phone, I guess. You run off battery for a while. Yeah, but I'm at a whiteboard halfway around the room now. Is this better?
Much better.
Okay. Thank you for letting us know you were there.
Hidden participants.
Hidden participants. Oh, man. Okay. Oh, this is so much fun. Keep going.
Goals.
Oh, we didn't hear about that? Okay.
Roles,
okay.
Decisions.
And relationships. A couple more.
Okay.
Objects.
Subjects,
okay. Okay.
Resources,
cool. Okay, so let's say that was our research and we found a whole bunch of stuff that wasn't in the original package. And so that's pretty cool. Now we're going to take a look at the semantics. So identifying the concepts and working definitions. That's probably going to be a little bit difficult. Let's look at it this way. Of these various terms that we have here, which ones do you think are going to have the most conflict over the definitions? Which definitions are going to have the least consensus?
Goals. Relationships.
You know, I would have liked to write the last column. Somebody that made another language to put in a term similar to, but not exactly what those terms are.
Okay.
Because most of those have to deal with people in multiple organizations with boundaries that are crossing, and you're going to get into different
terminology, whether it's a foreign language or just different words for the same thing. Yeah, and that, you know, to kind of critique where we're at in terms of how we try to run this process in a production form, you know, this initial group is simply too divergent. It doesn't have enough focus. And the goal of this exercise was not to expand the conceptual domain, but really to, like you said, Bruce, find related terms that are either the same way of expressing the idea, or a different way of expressing the same idea, or is very, very similar or very, very close. Like switch versus router, and then switch router is kind of another concept that's in that domain.
How abstract is the concept which you're able to license yourself to say with the left columns to just get a person?
That was the using the criteria we use for coming up with these sets of terms. That is too diverse. because the goal here was to come up with stuff that was very, very closely related or dealt with some particular boundary between two technologies. And so we would pick terms on both sides of that boundary or things that all reflected roughly the same thing. And because of that, this exercise is just as much fun as I thought it was going to be. Kind of like, I got to say it, herding cats. Sad. Okay, so high conflict. I think cloud. Are we talking UML mode or are we talking in meteorological mode? Anything else jump out here as being focused of conflict? Process? Yeah. Management? Is there a good, solid definition of management everyone can agree to?
Not likely.
Not likely. Okay. So, go ahead. Okay. An agent. Well, and that's interesting. You said drop out the bottom two. Because my thinking when I said which ones are the ones that are high conflict, looking at this exercise, these would be the ones I would focus on first. So if we've got a lot of conflict over the definitions for those terms, then those are the ones we want to focus on. Let's find the concepts that are associated with those terms and try to pin down definitions of those concepts. More thoughts? I was expecting the second half of the sentence. The goal here is, if these all relate to a small number of concepts, what are the additional terms which are going to color those concepts? Yeah. And the goal would be, by looking at these other terms, we might be able to clarify the corner cases and boundaries conceptually for the first set of terminology. That was kind of the goal of the exercise. Okay. So let's say we found these key terms and we worked up some definitions and we fought over the definitions and figured out that some of it's really ambiguous and we've got multiple concepts here. So that's what we'd be doing in step two. Let's go to the second sub-bullet. What's the core concept? Is there a core concept here that everything kind of hangs off of? What could it be?
I guess it has to be something in the real world, like something that an organization or a group is trying to accomplish. So I would vote for something like task.
Okay. So we're thinking. It's a task-oriented marriage? Yeah? I didn't even know where to go with that one. Okay, so your suggestion was task?
The thought. No one else is speaking.
I hear you. I decided my line was too ambiguous. Okay, so, and this is kind of that relationship model, right? So, if we made goal the core concept, then we could have tasks out here, and say a task enables the goal.
Task resources.
Resources enable a goal.
Tasks typically require resources.
Resources enable the task.
Dependency.
Okay.
Dependency.
Is there a relationship between resources and capability?
abstract to your capabilities or resources?
Resources are drawn from your capability. I'm just making this up as I go. Anyway, so, you know, and I think what you're hopefully seeing here is the idea, and not like this is the only way it's been done, by getting these concepts and terms in proximity to each other, let's try to figure out what the patterns are. Let's figure out how they relate.
But I was troubled by something. 30 years ago, we used to torture our students by making them do this sort of thing.
Right.
Less formal, but we give them away and say, go out and build a taxonomy. We wouldn't have fancy terms like that probably for this. And some of them would go out and do it very well, and others would do it very poorly. But if I found myself in this situation, I think the first thing I would do is go out and try to find whether somebody has already done this. So, for example, I would be very surprised if you read a management textbook if you didn't find some kind of informal formalization of how to think about the interrelationships of a lot of these issues. And so it feels a little awkward to me to be sitting here ab initio, like one of my students 30 years ago, sort of making it up from whole cloth, because I feel very nervous that I'm going to overlook some really important things.
Right. But I think that's the difference between what we're doing here in this room today, which is just kind of walking through the process, versus how it works in the real world. You know, that's what my goal was for step one, which is the research. You know, especially for management terminology, right? There's gobs of stuff. And what would probably happen there is you'd go out and you'd find one and you'd say, this looks good. And the folks participating in the process would debate, is that adequate or is it missing something? So it's almost a quality or validation of externally produced models and definitions. But switch and router, there is no authoritative source to go to. The team had to work that one out. Yeah. And, you know, yeah. And given that we're just kind of doing this in about an hour instead of over the span of about a month, you know, it takes on a real artificiality for very appropriate reasons. So, like I said, the idea was to try to find the core concept. Why did you consider? Why did the team consider that the core concept? Figure out how these other concepts relate to it. Try to draw some sort of a picture. And then that moved us into the next step, which is the normalization of semantics. I'll move over here. And so the goal was, let's come up with some working definitions. Do you want me to make you define these terms? But I got 15 minutes to fill. If I don't make you define terms, I'll let you out early. I'm not sure I'm allowed to do that. I think they want to be let out early, Bob.
What's the difference between step three and step four? You're normalizing.
Well, one's focusing on the definitions and the semantic side of it. What do the concepts mean? How do you describe their meaning? And then it's part of really trying to get those concepts cleaned up and get, you know, maybe I've got one term and it's really got five meanings. When I try to define that in more detail, that's going to fall out, and I'm realizing I'm dealing with multiple concepts.
Okay, so then you end up in step four, back where you started in step one, the terms that are informed by group consensus around the meanings or the distinctions in meanings.
I think the answer to that's yes. That, you know, again, this tends to be definitional. The step three is definitional. Step four, we're trying to take those, hopefully by this point the definitions have really stabilized quite a bit, or we know they haven't. We know this whole domain is going to require, this whole set of concepts is going to require more work. But once those definitions stabilize, then we can say, okay, for these concepts, hopefully we're moving from just terms into concepts at that point, what's the best term for that concept? Is switch router really the best term, or is there something else going on there? And switch router as a term actually confuses everybody with what that's really all about. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, phone person. Did you have a question? Phone still there? I believe so. Okay.
this doesn't be a goal-driven strategy.
Right.
It's necessary to create global definitions we can get by with, our local definitions are sufficient for the process.
Well, I would say for what this team had to do, the goal for this project, we needed global definitions. And the reason for that was we were trying to get interoperability across multiple systems and multiple organizations. And the conceptual differences between those organizations, one, hampered human communication, but more importantly, when it was embedded inside the automated systems, it really hampered that interoperability. We were trying to figure out really where those core conceptual breakdowns were so that we could get some sort of agreement and enable them to go out and build their system. It's kind of the federated side, right? There wasn't going to be any master architecture that all these systems had to conform to. Individual budgets, individual work groups. And we needed enough uniformity of understanding of some of these core concepts that when they went out and built their systems independently, there was still some hope that they'd be able to get alignments for, you know, critical data pieces. So, yeah, they just needed it. And in fact, looking at the dynamic of the project, from a political standpoint, this was actually one of the easiest projects I'd initiated, because the breakdowns were rampant throughout the entire organization. And once you said, here's the problem area that we've defined that we want to attack, everyone said, I got that problem. I experience it every day and it's killing me. And we want to try to attack it. I'm behind you. Whatever you come up with, I'll use it. I don't even care if it makes sense. Just as long as it's standardized, I'll use it.
That's what I mean by global. I mean, you did a local definition within the company. Was that enough to get
the attack? Oh, a local definition within the company instead of across the industry.
Right. Instead of looking to see everything else that may possibly out there, or
right,
usage that somebody used in, you know, the other side of the world.
Yeah.
Within the company.
Yeah, I would say company definitions or company standardization was more than adequate. Now, if it also matched, I'll get to you in a second. If it also matched global stuff, great. But recognize that part of what gave this company competitive advantage was it drove the global language. So what it did was going to become a global standard more than likely regardless. And at some point, there's probably a lag between their language and the world's, and that's competitive advantage for the next 18 months. So, you know, the trend was that way, but it wasn't really a prerequisite. Yeah.
So this discussion kind of motivates my observation. In my experience, anyway, there ought to be sort of a really step zero there that scope this. And at the outset, state where things are in. So we're
right.
It seems kind of obvious, but particularly if you were in a company today that's been merged and acquired and things like that, it's really critical because you could spend months talking about, you know, thinking that you're in agreement and suddenly discovering that you're not because this term is used slightly differently over there. Or this other term is in, just as part of the world, but it's not any place else.
Well, and that was, and we didn't, I mean, my involvement with the project ended before we had enough information that I could begin to see those patterns. But I expected that we would have been able to identify almost exactly those patterns, that you would have found portions of the organizations were actually the wellsprings of the concepts and terminology. And the wording, the language would first show up there. And then from there it would move out, and as it moved across these organizational boundaries, people think they knew what was being meant, but they'd shift stuff. And it would propagate and, you know, get chaotic, well, plus just the naming variations, which was really one of the core issues.
How do you avoid in this process particularly strong personalities or perspectives from really overtaking the process and the concept?
I don't know that you can completely prevent that. The teams were really small. But what we tried to do to reduce that was, first, we got people from different organizations, different disciplines. Again, the core three were engineering, marketing, and technical documentation. Tech doc people had to synthesize and make sense of both ends, so they tend to identify the conflicts relatively early. Marketing and engineering knew they didn't agree with each other. So that was kind of a natural source of conflict in the process. And I would say that there was enough conflict built in that it was hard for any one individual or mindset to dominate. Though, like I said, you had the one guy for marketing, and he said, blah, 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 blah. Everyone went, hallelujah. Well, what happened, and this was kind of the other way the process was nailed out, you know, as you get further and further down here, and you try to become more and more precise, you know, that dominant personality becomes less effective because you're trying to make it explicit. And as you try to make it explicit, the personality becomes less relevant to the discussion. And that was a phenomenon that we saw specifically in that one little work group. You know, as the new information, as the research came in, it was like, and he himself said, I was off. You know. I think he had one.
Yeah. How about it, before I start, I assume you are coming out on terms in the one domain?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And before all of this, we had a large process. We took multiple databases. We took stuff from the search system. We had really about 20 major data sources and another 20 to 40 secondary sources. And we went in there and literally extracted the language and we categorized it. And we said, okay, you know, all these terms relate to technology. All these terms relate to product. So that was one distinction. You know, here are terms that are related to processor behaviors. And so we put them into big buckets. And then we followed them down from that and said, you know, these things are pretty close. And what we got down to were groups of really three or four terms that were really closely related, and those became the work package that went into this.
The terms you used kind of bottom up.
It was.
How about like from top down?
I can think of it. I can envision a top-down process. I would see it being more model-driven. So you'd go a top-down process. I think would be more constructing of a model. It just wasn't applicable in this business setting for the problem we were trying to solve. But I don't see a reason you couldn't use a top-down one. I think the challenge compared to what we did here is that if you're taking a top-down process, you would need to engage your subject matter experts longer for more extended periods of time, and you'd have to engage them at a deeper level of involvement. We were doing this over the course of about four meetings, and each meeting lasted about an hour. So we were really trying to minimize the impact of time on subject matter experts. We didn't want a lot of previous knowledge of the task to be required for them to do it. So they only meet for a little bit, and then they kind of work up some exercise to go do offline, and off they go. Because one of the big concerns we had was scalability. We didn't want to have a lot of labor going to this, so it had to be, you know, very short meetings and only a handful of them. A top-down process, I think you're developing a body of expertise on how you get from the top down to the deals, and that would be really a different resourcing approach. Now, in terms of this process, sitting alongside it, we had the engineering team, and they were taking a more top-down approach. And in fact, the issues they bumped into in doing the top-down prioritized which sets of concepts were handed over to these work groups. So it was a bit of both. But as far as these groups were concerned, you're right, it was bottom-up. And a lot of the source material, even for that modeling, was bottom-up from the existing databases we were trying to integrate. Bob, I think you had a question.
Yeah. There's a methodology component of these four steps, five steps, seven steps. And part of that involves the review of the top-down or bottom-up or combo. Combination of top down and bottom up. Arguing this in academia for 45 years, I remember Peter Schenker back in 67, 68, had to wait for it, just like this. And we've got, well, let's not make me quite that old, about 75. But I've had, some concerns about actually how long this takes. It's labor intensive, very labor intensive. A former PhD student of mine did this, yep, with the vice president of the corporation. And the conservative figure he estimated was $13 million in 18 months. Others were taking a little different tack. And this was defining customer. So whiteboard. He used Photoshop. He used several plugins for Photoshop. It was fairly successful. And Photoshop has jumped to a much better and a larger corporation that wanted to do the same basic stuff. So top down, bottom up, amounts of cost. Seems like with the meta knowledge, we're better informed about using the concepts. Denise Bedford is calling her five-step, or actually seven-step, top-down approach to building a bottom-up approach to building a top-down ontology. Just to put the concepts on a strategy as we start noodling with the other step. Is there any disagreement that this is step zero or step almost zero, step one? Is it that conceptual consensus and the semantics that are involved before we start putting in the theories and start putting in the technical solution?
You did remind me of one thing, actually, kind of the top-down debate. One of the big top-down debates was feature versus technology. What's the difference between a feature and a technology? Because the two terms were used routinely in conversation. And no one really had any agreed understanding of what they meant or when you'd use one versus the other. It was really kind of an interesting debate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one thing I alluded to but didn't really say directly was that as the whole metadata issue surfaced and was moved into actual project activities, the person who basically took on management of that task was...
Your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
Thank you. The person who actually took ownership of this project was the guy who was in charge of the search system. And so we had very, very explicit practical goals of what we were trying to accomplish in the first generation. We had stakeholders throughout the company, and we made sure that we understood what their needs were, and we did as much as we could to enable those and line the project up to meet the broad requirement. But yeah, it was focused specifically that you got to be able to type in something to find the documents about it. So there were some very, very explicit targets in terms of performance.
I think the answer to your question depends on the type of application you're doing. If you're doing an IT application, this is an essential part. If you're doing something different, like an automated process or something like that, there aren't a lot of people involved. You're plugging in a machine project. This is a lot of extra effort. It might be useful or might not be useful. I worked on some systems that were just simulation systems. And just like to see what happened on the end.
Once you had a model and it supported the behaviors, you were fine.
So you need to get a lot of consensus about how the different simulations represent things. I need to find an engineering solution for that problem. Slightly different.
Any other comments or questions? We're now a minute over. I think that was it. Thank you, everybody.
Looking more intently at semi-formal and formal oncology for some case studies and more details. See you soon.
Peter, I'm going to give this back to you now. You said we got about 10 minutes. Hey, Doug.
confrontational there.
I enjoyed it.
I really was.
It was good.
I thought you were looking for...
It was... I really was. And if you hadn't, I would have run out of stuff to say at least half hour ago.
The problem was 60 slides and then venture on. So people were still trying to suggest.
Well, the one I was really kind of hoping for, the one I had played with doing was... ontology, taxonomy, folksonomy, that type of stuff. And I had thought about that, and then after taking a look at the stuff that Denise had provided, I pitched a question to her last night thinking she'd come up with a real good little cluster out of her work. And it didn't show up, or I didn't get it, so I got here realizing I don't have a list.
Well, it's
something happened.
Yeah.
You know, it was a good launching point for conversation.
Anyway,
thank you.
Yeah.